You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, kids sports has become big business, and that's changed the experience for young people and their families today. We'll talk to the author of the new book, Take Back the Game, who says we need to bring fun back to youth sports. Now, the FBI searched former President Donald Trump's property in Mar-a-Lago earlier this month and retrieved a number of government documents. Last Friday, the Justice Department released a redacted affidavit making the case for that search warrant. The Justice Department was instructed to release the redacted affidavit after a Florida judge ruled the document was in the public's interest. Along with that 38-page document, the Justice Department released a memorandum explaining why part of it was redacted, not visible to the public. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been following this story? Have you read the documents or read about them? What surprises you? What confuses you? What questions do you have about what this all means, how it works? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Scott Anderson is a fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution. He's also senior editor and general counsel at Lawfare. Scott, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Talk us through the process here and what this affidavit is and what it means.
Sure. Well, before it executed the search on former President Trump's Mar-a-Lago estate, the FBI and the Justice Department had to go to a judge, a magistrate judge in Florida, and make the case that there was probable cause that certain crimes had been committed and that evidence related to those crimes was located on Mar-a-Lago, on the estate, or at least parts of the estate. That's a requirement for getting a certain warrant to conduct a certain type of search. And usually the evidence that's provided to back that up comes in the form of an affidavit by an FBI agent laying out under oath, here are all the investigatory steps we've taken, the evidence we've recovered, and things along those lines. The affidavits usually are not made part of the public record, but as you note in the introduction, in this case, the judge determined it was warranted to make at least parts of it, release at least parts of it to the public, given the high level of public interest in this case. That's what happened this past Friday. But it's worth noting the final version was heavily redacted, so we only got little snippets of the full thing, not the actual full affidavit.
Right. This is a pretty routine procedure, except, as you just mentioned, and I want to highlight this point, usually the public will never see any version of that affidavit, right?
Certainly not before the trial, a criminal trial or investigation. Sometimes they will be challenged the sufficiency of the affidavit or the legitimacy of the search warrant if there are misrepresentations. So sometimes you'll see them brought forward in courts as parts of legal challenges. But barring that, it's usually part of the background of an investigation that never hits the public eye.
So this affidavit did hit the public eye, or lots of it, with lots blacked out. What did we learn from this affidavit?
Really, the affidavit confirms a lot of things that had already been reported. We do know that the National Archives was engaged in conversations with former President Trump's team at Mar-a-Lago about recovering several boxes of documents that were taken from the White House at the end of his administration in violation initially of the Presidential Records Act. It's a statute that says presidential records have to be given to the National Archives and retained and preserved for historical record and for the use of future administrations. They spent several months trying to get these records back. They eventually succeeded in getting several boxes back. But when they searched through them, they found a wide array of documents, many, many, many documents that were labeled with different types of classification tags indicating classified information of different types. At some point, this led them to initiate a referral to the Federal Bureau of Investigation and the Justice Department, who then kind of took over the investigation and undertook an effort to recover classified information, other classified information they had reason to believe was still at Mar-a-Lago. And that ultimately is what precipitated this search.
Can you talk about some of the different levels of classification that apparently we know were present in that first batch of documents retrieved by the FBI and in this latest batch from the search warrant? Briefly, what levels of classification, what do they mean?
Sure. There's a lot of different types of classification labels. Usually there's kind of a three-tier system, confidential, secret, top secret, which is kind of the three categories or levels of classification from least to most serious. But then particularly at the top secret level, you have lots of special designations or at lower levels as well. So sometimes you'll see something called NOFORN, N-O-F-O-R-N. That's a label that means it's not to be shared with foreign governments. Or you will see different types of labels for that indicate information was collected from human sources, meaning it might be particularly sensitive in regards to sources and methods, or might relate to certain special access programs that are special classified programs that even if you have a top secret clearance, you don't have access to those documents with that label unless you are cleared into that specific program. Evidently, according to the FBI, documents bearing almost all of these labels were found among the 15 boxes that were given back to NARA in January. And they state in the affidavit, although we don't know exactly what the basis for it is, they believed and eventually persuaded the magistrate judge there was probable cause to believe other documents with the same tags were still at Mar-a-Lago in the documents retained there by former President Trump and his staff.
Talking to Scott Anderson from the Brookings Institution and senior editor and general counsel at Lawfare. Looking at the latest news in the FBI search of President Trump's property in Florida, the many documents recovered there, possible legal liability. You can join in with your reactions to all of this, your questions about all of this at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Willem is with us in Colfax. Willem, hi.
Hi. I think it's sort of interesting about all the wrangling about this, but the main thing, as your guest already pointed out, was that it's against the presidential records law. And how did he get these and who transported them and all those kind of questions? And then the fact that the Republican Party thinks of themselves as a party of law and order. This isn't law and order. This is a reckless disregard for the law that this man has, demonstrated on many occasions. But the Republicans today don't seem to care about the rule of law or the fact that no man is above the law. So, you know, if I rob the bank, they don't care what kind of banknotes I took. I robbed the bank.
Willem, thanks for the call. Scott, to Willem's first point, regardless of the classification levels of these documents, in many cases, they weren't supposed to end up leaving government control.
That's exactly right. That's certainly been NARA's position since pretty early after the end of the Trump administration. In the affidavit, they actually point to media reports and footage of people loading boxes onto helicopters or onto trucks. I can't recall exactly the transportation mechanism, but essentially former President Trump's staff loading all these document boxes with him to go out of the White House. And that evidently is the thing that initially piqued NARA's concern, saying, they're not supposed to be taking any boxes of documents out of here. There's a process by which, you know, you can retain certainly personal effects, certain personal documents, but NARA at least needs to, in the first order, get and retain those on site and then eventually takes them to its own facility. That is what appears not to have happened in this particular case, but we don't know the full details about where all these documents came from and how they all got to Mar-a-Lago. There's been suggestions from some of former President Trump's allies and staff that a lot of the boxes at least were packed by government officials as part of his relocation effort. So there's been some effort to shift some blame to them as the people who actually boxed them. But again, there doesn't seem to be much doubt that they were retained with the knowledge of people at Mar-a-Lago for several months, regardless of who boxed them in the first instance.
I saw the president had pointed a finger at the GSE, the Government Services E-something, I can't remember what the E stands for, but they have responded saying they transported the documents, but it was that the president's staff who had packed things up initially. Another defense, another argument we've seen from the former president and supporters was that he had declassified the classified documents before removing them. From what we've seen, what do you make of that argument?
So it's a problematic argument for former President Trump to make. He's leaning on the fact that there is kind of an ongoing legal debate about when and where a president can declassify information. It's pretty well accepted that presidents, when they're in office, actually have very broad declassification authority, can declassify things pretty readily when they're president. There's a little bit more of a debate as to what extent they have to follow the procedures that they themselves and their predecessors in the White House have laid out for doing so. Can they just do it kind of with the word of mouth, or do they actually need to do things like follow procedures laid out in executive orders or issue a superseding executive order that would amend or introduce an exception to those procedures in specific cases? The problem for President Trump is that there's no evidence he actually took any steps to declassify these records while in office. he's suggested that he did so. Some of his advisors have suggested that he ordered it verbally or may have intended to do so even in his mind. It's been suggested on occasion, but there's no paper trail. And we know in other cases, when President Trump wanted something declassified, there was a paper trail. Actually, the day before he left office, he declassified a single binder of documents related to an investigation in which he was a part of Operation Crossfire Hurricane, excuse me. This was a single binder of documents, and he did it by issuing a presidential memorandum that was published in the Federal Register, a pretty clear documented process. There's no sign of anything like that happening while he was in office. And once he leaves the White House, he doesn't have the authority to take that sort of step. So it's not clear he actually did declassify anything, at least in any way that a court or any adjudicating authority could actually acknowledge or recognize or see any evidence supporting his assertions that he did so. Separate from that, there's also an open question as to whether it really matters, because all three of the criminal statutes the Justice Department pointed to in seeking the search warrant, two of them are routinely applied to cases where no classified information is involved whatsoever. So classification is pretty clearly relevant to them. The third one is usually applied to classified information. It's part of the Espionage Act. That proves somewhat controversial in a variety of other contexts. But the actual statutory language actually predates the classification system. And there is at least a credible argument that it could apply to certain other types of sensitive held information, even if it's not technically classified. And so you could see an argument, certainly, that one could violate the Espionage Act by mishandling sensitive government information, even if President Trump somehow did declassify it. Although, as I noted, there's not a very strong case that he did.
We're talking to Scott Anderson, fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution, about the latest news in the FBI search of former President Trump's resort in Florida. By the way, GSA, I misspoke, not GSA, General Services Administration. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see happen next? What questions do you have for our guest about these documents that the former president had held at Mar-a-Lago in Florida? If it turns out that these documents are held illegally, should charges be filed against the former president? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Scott Anderson, fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution. We're looking at the latest developments in the FBI's search of former President Trump's property in Florida, the documents retrieved from that property. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are you still hoping to learn about all this? Are you worried? Do you think charges will be filed against the former president? Do you think they should be? What questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Pat joins us now in Green Bay. Pat, hello.
Hi. Wow, I wasn't expecting this fast. Thank you, and good afternoon to your guest and yourself.
What did you want to bring up, Pat?
Well, I find it rather amazing that there should even be a discussion if former President Donald Trump committed a crime by taking stuff that he wasn't supposed to take, then he should be punished just like any other person. Just because he was the president, former president should not put him above the law.
Pat, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Scott, this is the big question mark, whether or not a former president will actually be charged with crimes. What could determine if those charges are filed over the coming weeks?
Sure. Well, the one thing I would say first off is that I don't think anyone should get their expectations up about there being charges in the immediate future, such as in the next several weeks in particular, or frankly, the next several months. The Justice Department has already been clear that this investigation is still in its early-ish stages. So there's still steps to go on. In a case that's as sensitive as this, they would only move forward after doing a very thorough investigation, checking all the boxes, dotting all the I's, crossing all the T's, particularly Merrick Garland. That is very much his style as an attorney throughout his career. And so I expect they will take their time to build whatever case they think is appropriate. There's also an informal Justice Department policy that avoids taking major investigatory steps in the weeks before an election, not informal, an actual DOJ policy. It doesn't clearly apply here because Donald Trump is not a candidate, but a lot of the considerations, policy considerations, still apply. So I suspect they're going to be very conservative moving forward. That said, you know, in a case like this involving the president, there's always going to be some reservation about taking a step that many people are going to see as very controversial. And that's going to raise, in some cases, potentially legitimate concerns about political abuse of power. In my mind, that tells me that the Justice Department's only likely to move forward where they can really build an airtight case that has something close to smoking gun evidence, evidence that is clearly in the facts, that's very incontrovertible. It doesn't hang on intent or on a particular interpretation of language or statements. This case does that. It's very clear that these documents were improperly held at Mar-a-Lago, barring the kind of constitutional Hail Mary argument that former President Trump is advancing. President Trump appears to have been aware of that. The Justice Department seems to have been careful to make him and his staff clearly aware of that in their communications beforehand, establishing they knew what they were doing is wrong, and they persevered in doing it anyway. In my view, that makes this case more so than the January 6th investigation or many other investigations that have and continue to hover around former President Trump, probably the single greatest source of potential liability for him and those in his inner circle who are involved in this incident. At least on the federal side, there's an investigation going on in Georgia that I think should be taken very seriously as well. It's simply because of the type of evidence. I think some people might not find that satisfying. They would like to see former President Trump investigated and charged, and those around him investigated and charged for their actions around the 2020 election or in relation to the January 6th insurrection. But I think these charges are much more likely to go forward because the evidence is so clean cut and so relative to those cases, so much more incontrovertible.
Let's go back to our callers. Russ is with us in Belleville. Russ, hi.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Well, I agree with the fact that this couldn't be more of an open and shut case. The documents are for the people of the United States, not Donald Trump. He shouldn't have had them. And the other thing that really concerns me is the rhetoric from the Republicans like Lindsey Graham saying if they indict the president, there might be civil war. That's just so irresponsible. The rhetoric is out of control. They'll do anything to defend this man, no matter what he does.
Russ, thanks for the call. Yeah, Senator Graham had warned of potentially riots in the streets if former President Trump were indicted. Does the Department of Justice, does Attorney General Garland have to keep that in mind, the possible backlash if charges were to be filed?
He does, and I'm sure he is, as are other senior Justice Department officials involved in this. And I believe this is something being handled primarily at the Justice Department. The Attorney General Garland and the Biden administration have been very clear about erecting a wall between the White House and the Justice Department, trying to reinforce that. Attorney General Garland takes that very seriously, made it a priority when he took the position. And I'm confident that he's being careful to avoid any inappropriate engagement with the White House or other parts of the administration on this and keeping it in the Justice Department. But they can't avoid these sorts of political considerations. They inherently, as a prosecutor, you exercise prosecutorial discretion, and that entails those sorts of policy judgments in terms of how you choose to move forward with any given case. That said, the countervailing interest there, as your callers have already noted, is that there's a real rule of law problem here. How much can you let people get away with something, particularly when the evidence is just so clear cut and incontrovertible that they did something illegal? I think that's a pretty strong countervailing interest in this case in particular, particularly given how important everyone agrees, of both parties agrees, handling classified information actually is. And so particularly if there was actually really sensitive information, as there appears to be in these documents, that really could have compromised national security, I think there's might be a strong inclination, at least big parts of the Justice Department, that they have to move forward in some regard with some sort of charges against somebody, maybe just in former President Trump's orbit, maybe not himself, but possibly himself as well.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Scott, I wanted to get into something else in the affidavit. Some of the redactions concerned witnesses and concerns that if witness names or identities were revealed directly or obliquely, that it could intimidate other witnesses, it could raise risks for those witnesses. What did you make of that?
Yeah, it was a really interesting part of the affidavit that was unredacted. And in it, the Justice Department actually cited, I'm sorry, this is in the memorandum justifying the Justice Department's redactions, the affidavit, I should say. And in it, the Justice Department actually cites a finding by the magistrate judge himself in earlier proceedings where he said essentially, look, if information, even little tidbits of information about these witnesses were to come forward, there's a very real chance that people on social media or out on the internet would be able to piece it together, alluding to a sort of crowdsourcing investigation as has become kind of commonplace these days with these high profile incidents. And that could lead people to identify those witnesses and potentially harass them, intimidate them, or subject them to threats of violence. And the Justice Department ran with this argument. And as evidence, they pointed to the fact that several FBI agents whose identities were revealed when former President Trump and his staff revealed parts of the search warrant with their names on it have already been subjected to harassment and threats of violence, as have other FBI personnel. So it's really this kind of unique aspect of this case, because it's so high profile, the Justice Department and the judge seem to have recognized that you need to, even though parts of this affidavit need to come forward to present to satisfy the public curiosity, those parts touching on witnesses really need to be protected, perhaps even more than in lower profile cases. And they appear to have taken that step here. The other point I note here is that they refer to witnesses in the plural, and that strongly suggests that the Justice Department has multiple witnesses supporting its case for probable cause and presumably future case of any sort of criminal investigation it may bring forward. So that strongly suggests that they have done their due diligence and have built a relatively strong case based on multiple witnesses, not just a single witness whose credibility may be brought into question.
In just our last 15 seconds or so, this was a fast-moving story. You warned in something you wrote lately, don't get used to that. This could move very slowly from here on out, potentially.
I think that's exactly right. I think a lot of people are going to get a little frustrated because the stream of information we've gotten on this case is likely to shrink to a trickle. But it's very clear the Justice Department is taking this seriously and moving forward at a deliberate speed, albeit mostly outside the public eye. So I don't think this is the last we're going to hear of this investigation, but people should be ready to endure a little bit of silence for the next few months as the Justice Department goes about its very important work, which they do outside of the public eye for very good reasons, including the protection of the privacy of former President Trump and those who work with them that are the subject of this investigation.
We'll leave it there. Scott, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
That's Scott Anderson from the Brookings Institution, senior editor and general counsel at the blog Lawfare. Scott talked to us about the FBI search of former President Trump's Florida resort and the release of the affidavit requesting that search warrant. Now, you might sign kids up to play sports for a lot of reasons. They get to exercise, learn about teamwork, maybe make some friends along the way. But our next guest says youth sports have changed a lot over the last few decades. She's been an athlete, the parent of an athlete, and a coach herself. She says there's less of an emphasis now on fun, a bigger focus on competitiveness, driven in part by the multi-billion-dollar youth sports industry and by college sports. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you had an experience in youth sports lately? Has it become too expensive? Has your family been priced out of some sports completely? Are we grown-ups putting too much pressure on kids to compete at a high level instead of having fun and getting exercise? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Linda Flanagan is a freelance journalist, researcher, and former track and cross-country coach. Her new book is Take Back the Game, How Money and Mania Are Ruining Kids' Sports and Why It Matters. Linda, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
In your book, Linda, you highlight a lot of the problems with youth sports. We'll get to those, but in a lot of ways, you really love athletics, at least their potential. Before we get to the negatives, what would a good, positive youth sports culture look like?
Oh, it would look reasonable. It would involve a supportive coach who looked out for all the kids on the team, was gearing the practices up so that they suited the kids' developmental level. They would be moderate. They would be age appropriate. So you wouldn't have a five-year-old having practices 4 days a week and two games on the weekend. There would be opportunities for growth, development, to learn about teamwork. The coach would, of older kids, would help them understand the application of what they've learned on the team to the rest of their life. So they would learn beyond, the X's and O's of a game. I mean, there's all kinds of wonderful things you can learn from sports. And I'm a big believer in what they can do for you. And I've benefited so much myself. It's just that they've changed so much that we've lost a lot of that.
Let's get into some of those changes. One of them I mentioned is the money. Could you talk about just how much that has exploded as an industry?
Yes, it's really kind of shocking that it is a $19 billion industry. That's B, billion. And to put it in context, the NFL is a $15 billion industry. And it has just taken off. Since 2010, it has grown 90%. And, you know, the long short of it is there's a lot of people profiting off your family.
Now, a big part of the problem is, and I'll admit, I'm a sports parent myself. I wasn't the worst one out there, but there are things I wish I had done differently. What is driving parents to define ourselves in a way by what our kids do out there on some sort of athletic field?
You know, it's such an interesting question, and it really does go beyond athletics, but, sports are so popular. They're the most popular extracurricular activity that's where we see it the most. But there's been a change in the perspective, adult perspective on childhood, and a new understanding of what we parents think we owe our kids. As the great journalist Jennifer Senior put it, she said, "Children have moved from our employees to our bosses." And I think that really, that hits home and really resonates, because it can sometimes feel like our kids' schedules and lives are the deciding factor of what the family does. And this is more so than in the past, that parents derive status from their offspring. And I explain more about how that happened in my book.
Are kids still having fun out there, or have we grown-ups in a lot of ways sucked the fun out of the games?
Well, I mean, of course, that's one of the giant problems is that, everyone says this, everyone I spoke to, and I talked to so many people about youth sports and what's changed and where they're headed. And, one of the common themes is that they're just not fun anymore. They're serious. You see third graders with their uniforms and they're tucked in, and there's an official walking by to make sure they have regulation socks on. And it's just become more about adults and, commercialism than it is about, the kids' enjoyment. And, that's a real loss, because some of the kids will quit and never really develop athletically.
Talking to Linda Flanagan about her new book, Take Back the Game, How Money and Mania Are Ruining Kids' Sports and Why It Matters. You can join in with your experiences as a youth athlete now or in the past, as a parent thereof, a coach, a ref. What are you seeing? What do you wish could change about the game, whichever game it is? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Linda, before we go to our callers, I want to go to another piece of the puzzle that looms over everything: college sports. How have changes in college sports driven what we're seeing at younger and younger ages?
Well, it's not just changes at sports in colleges and universities. It's also about just broader changes at those institutions overall. I mean, for one, they cost a fortune. Everyone knows that tuition costs are staggeringly high. It's $44,000 a year is the average cost for a national private university. It's $12,000 for a state university. I mean, these are just giant expenses. And on top of that, the perception is that it is much harder for kids to get in. And there's a lot of data to back that up. So there's a lot of insecurity about where kids are going to go. And parents worry that they're not going to be able to go to the same level school that perhaps they went to. And then you have sports. And they seem to offer not exactly a shortcut, but another way in. Because sports, they generally offer more athletes in who have somewhat lower academic standards. There's a streamlined recruiting process. And of course, there's $3.6 billion in scholarship money, athletic scholarship money that, can be dangled before parents to make it seem like, well, this might be the way in.
And that gets to this incentive structure, I think, for parents. Well, if I hold off on my kids starting whatever sport it is until fourth grade, and all those other kids are already in since kindergarten, are they behind? Are they going to be able to keep up? Are they going to compete for that college admission or maybe that D1 scholarship, or however much of a long shot that might be? It's an arms race, right?
Yes, yes. I mean, I really wish someone, and maybe I'll do this one day, would figure out what the investment would be if parents took the money they put into their kids' sports and put it into, you know, an index fund or something, and over 10 years and saw what that ballooned to versus what they're going to get out on the other end of it. Because, you know, 2% of high school athletes, first of all, only 6% of high school athletes even play sports in college. Only 2% get any kind of scholarship money at all. You know, if that's why you're doing it, it's really playing the lottery.
You're worried about the kids mainly, but you also talk about the stress that the travel, the time, the money puts on parents and families. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, I mean, I really think it's kind of an underappreciated problem how much sports have kind of taken over family life. It's like it's kind of an alternate universe for those families that are involved in it, where, you know, if it's there's a two-parent household, there's a lot of dividing and conquering. One parent drives the son to Virginia for a lacrosse tournament, and the mother drives the daughter to Connecticut for a soccer tournament. There's just a lot of disruption in families, and also for siblings who, you know, somehow are either dragged along or expected to follow along. It's not all good by any means. And it's hard. It can be hard on marriages. We have little data on that. But if you ask around, you can see that there's no way it can't have an effect on marriages and on family finances.
We're talking to Linda Flanagan, journalist, former track and cross country coach, with us today to talk about her new book. It's called Take Back the Game: How Money and Mania Are Ruining Kids' Sports and Why It Matters. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you? Are you one of these families that's gone all in on youth sports? Did it creep up on you? Did you find yourself spending more money, more time on sports? If you are a youth yourself, if you're into sports, do you feel a lot of pressure, or are you able to have fun doing it? And how about the atmosphere at kids' games? A lot of people yelling at the referees, arguing with the coaches, overcoaching from the parent sidelines. What are you seeing? How can we fix it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Linda Flanagan about her new book. It's Take Back the Game: How Money and Mania Are Ruining Kids' Sports and Why It Matters. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, your own experience with youth sports as a parent, a family member, a coach, a referee, maybe a young person yourself. Do you see problems? What still makes it worthwhile if you think it is? Are there changes you'd like to see, whether it's behavior of parents on the sidelines or bigger changes in the whole system? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We heard from Kathy in Deerfield, who says her kids are grown. They raised them back in the 80s now. And back then when they were in club sports, Kathy says they were upset. The coaches at club sports are upset that the kids took the summer off and that the kids played multiple sports. So this has been around for a while. Linda, this is a story you've run into a lot. Why are you playing another sport? Yes. Why are you taking time off of our sport and things like that?
Yes, yes. And that's only gotten worse. I mean, it's even just over the last decade, you know, clubs and private teams are expecting athletes to not only play during the summer, but, you know, by the way, play what would traditionally be considered a spring sport in the fall and the winter too. There's just more heaped on kids and their families, more expectations. And it's very hard to resist. So, you know, kudos to the mom who did, because it's hard to resist that kind of pressure.
Thanks for that call, Kathy. Another consequence we haven't gotten into that you're right about, Linda, is risk of injuries, often, especially if we overdo just one sport. What are you seeing there?
Yeah, I mean, the medical people I spoke to, the sports doctors, the common word they used was epidemic. They said there's an epidemic of overuse injuries. And I should add, overuse injuries are completely preventable. They're just from using, various parts of the body too much for too long. It's repetitive use. There's an epidemic of overuse injuries. And in Tommy John surgery, we all know about that. I spoke to an orthopedic doctor who said he's been performing this surgery on 12-year-olds. You know, there are more stress fractures, growth plate injuries, injuries to knees and tendons. You know, for young women, there's the female athlete triad. These sort of what you could consider chronic or kind of debilitating injuries, like overuse injuries. And then there are also the more catastrophic ones like ACL tears, which have become an enormous problem. They're devastating injuries that to the knee, and you know, it puts kids on the sidelines for, you know, 6 to 12 months and gets them out of their sport. And what I found, I was shocked to discover that doctors are saying that half of the people who tear their ACLs will have arthritis in that knee in 10 years. You know, and in my community, you know, it seems like every other week I'm hearing about usually a girl, often a middle school girl, another girl on the team, on the lacrosse team, tore her ACL. Well, if that girl is 12 or 13, she could be hobbling around, you know, at 23 with arthritis. So it's not just a short term. It's not just, you know, oh, this season you're on the sidelines. It can have, you know, longer term consequences down the road.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Jesse is with us in Madison. Jesse, hello.
Hello.
Sorry, Jesse, your connection is not great. Jesse told our call screener he's been coaching for 17 years, seen a transition of kids sports into almost semi-pro. Parents are praying their kids go pro, and parents give them lots of instructions on where and when to play their kid. Do you hear this a lot from coaches, Linda?
Oh, God. I mean, that's so typical. It's just, you know, they're like the parents have become like agents on the sidelines to some extent. And it is just, you know, very counter to what youth sports are supposed to be for, which is children's development and appreciation for sports. You know, a vanishingly small number of kids are going to go on to play professionally. It's, you know, this idea that somehow if the parent yells the right instruction on the sideline, it's going to make the difference is simply wrong. And it is not helpful to either the child or the coach.
Thanks for calling in, Jesse. Sorry we lost you there at 800-642-1234. Talk to Linda Flanagan about youth sports. Her book is called Take Back the Game, How Money and Mania Are Ruining Kids Sports and Why It Matters. Still time for you to share your story, your question, maybe your solutions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Linda, let's talk about some of your solutions. One big one that I guess, well, you even suggest we won't hold our breath on is getting rid of college sports as we know it and going to club and intramural sports. As a thought exercise, what would that look like? How would it help?
Well, I mean, just imagine for a minute if college sports were run the way high school sports are, so that kids, you know, if they wanted to join the football team or the tennis team, they tried out at the start of this season. They arrive on campus and then they decide they're going to try out for the team and the coach picks them. I mean, it's so alien to the way it's done now with this giant and expensive recruiting process. But if you had tryouts, say, but you still had intramural sports and you had club sports, so kids could still play. The incentive structure for the club teams and the privatization of youth sports and commercialization of it would evaporate, because much of what drives some of the nonsense is this hope that kids will be recruited and perhaps they'll get into a better college. That would eliminate the problem. But again, I'm not holding my breath. It's not going to happen.
Let's bring out another caller now. Reed is with us in Whitewater. Reed, hello.
Hello.
What did you want to ask about?
I was curious your thoughts about the mental health issues that also come with very competitive sports at a young age. When I was playing soccer competitively, it was just destructive to have coaches and parents just rail on other kids / yell at kids who are 12, 11, 10, and just tell you, you know, you suck. You have to go join another team. You're kicked off the team. Why not?
Reed, thanks for the call. Linda, again, probably more common than we'd like, the mental health impact.
I mean, it's just so terrible. And it still shocks me that that we kind of allow this, that, you know, we have this carve out for atrocious behavior in sports that we just would never dream of allowing in the classroom or the workplace. And I think, you know, we are seeing more attention being paid to this at the college level because we've had some, you know, some terrible suicides over the past year or so. And it's called attention to the fact that, you know, it's certainly at the college level, there's so enormous amount of pressure and stress and sleep deprivation that goes on. And it's just that is kind of trickling down, certainly to high school, too, where kids feel a ton of pressure. And, you know, I want to add, some kids can take it. Some kids love it. They thrive on that competitiveness. But, you know, a good portion, it's too much for them.
Thanks for that call, Reed. You've got a lot of solutions in the book, Linda, for parents and families. I want to look at the community level for a moment. You highlight some communities that have rethought how they approach youth sports. What are some of the best lessons we could do at that level?
Well, I think if you look at, say, the high school, there's a high school I profile, Tuscarora High School in Maryland, that has shifted the way it views sports in that it's not just all after school. They do intramural and they have intramural classes, sports during the day. They offer a lot of club programs. They offer programs for kids with disabilities, physical and intellectual. And their purpose is inclusion. And, you know, it is just it's a healthier environment. 53% of the kids at that school participate in sports. And, you know, there are ways to kind of shift it from this ultra serious win at all costs, you know, short term success that is the kind of defines youth sports now.
And that raises a really big point here, Linda. One consequence of all of this doesn't have anything to do with the kids who are in these high pressure sports environments. We have lots and lots of kids who don't get much exercise, who aren't involved in these group activities. How do we make sure we get them out there, too?
I know. Well, that's the, you know, one of the terrible consequences of this commercialization is that, you know, so many kids are just edged out of sports. It's like entirely participation in sports is essentially class-based. And, you know, some people in leadership positions are striving to correct that. I profile in the book a woman named Monica Wallace, who's a council member in New York State, and she lobbied when Governor Cuomo introduced legislation to allow for mobile sports betting. She lobbied to include a provision that would carve out $5 million every year to go to low-income areas where children are denied or don't have access to sports. So that there are, you know, around the edges, there are efforts being made to where among, you know, leaders and people who have some authority who can address this to repair it on the margins. And, you know, that's just one state. I believe other states have taken similar steps.
Linda, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Linda Flanagan. She's a freelance journalist, researcher, and former track and cross-country coach. She was with us today to talk about her new book. It's called Take Back the Game, How Money and Mania Are Ruining Kids' Sports and Why It Matters. There is still time for you to share your experiences, negative or positive. If you were involved in a team, a community that you think got things right, love to hear about that. Post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Again, look for the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can also email us, ideas@wpr.org, to share your experiences in youth sports for better or for worse.